We're going to continue our little walk through the story of Jesus as told by Mark's gospel, my favorite gospel. For perhaps if you don't know me, my name is Mark Tilden. I'm one of the elders here and teachers, and I really love the gospel of Mark for a whole bunch of reasons, not just because I was named after him. But before we do that, I want to ask you a question. And we start a lot of times with questions, but this one's a little unusual because you have to answer, okay? The good news is it's easy. It's a true-false, agree-disagree. So what I'd like you to do, I'm going to read a very simple statement, and I want you to decide if you agree or disagree with this statement, and then I want you to raise your hand. I'll tell you which time when, and nobody gets to abstain, okay? You got to decide, all right? Here's the statement. You always do what you want to do. You always do what you want to do. Okay? So, let's start with those who disagree. Raise your hand if you disagree with that statement. Okay? All right. Now, a few of you who have raised your hand and said, I disagree, tell me why. Why do you disagree? What's that? Did I hear, do you have kids? Is that what I heard? I totally understand. Been there, done that. Okay? What's that? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I mean, to be quite honest, there are any number of times I get up in the morning and I really don't want to go to work. Okay. Anybody else? Okay, let's try the other side. How many of you agree? I saw a minority. And by the way, you can, I think you can change your mind, but nobody abstains. Okay. How many of you would agree with the statement, you always do what you want to do? Okay, we're in a minority. I know, it's a little ambiguous. It was designed that way, okay? Okay, how, those of you who agree, why? Yeah, okay, good. Anybody else? Yeah. Cool. So it really comes down to motivation, doesn't it? It really kind of comes down to, what do I want? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the part of the ambiguity of this statement, I guess. And, you know, the story that we're going to look at tonight in Mark 7 is a really interesting discussion between Jesus and the Pharisees about motivation, about what they were doing. And I know that, you know, most of us kind of, I think we understand at least at some level what our motivations are. You know, I'd like to make a little more money. I'd like to be safe and secure. I'd like to whatever. But I think a lot of us don't really know what's going on below the surface. And this passage in Mark 7 really begins to point out some of those deeper motivation issues. So let's go there. What we're going to see is that the first part of this passage, Jesus has one of his kind of typical dialogues with the Pharisees, a little bit of a confrontation. And then he goes on and talks sort of, I don't know if it's just turn around, but he ends up talking to his disciples and explaining some of the dialogue. And I wish we had time. There's a beautiful model here of making disciples, because Jesus is making disciples in the context of doing ministry and interacting with the Pharisees. We don't have time for that. So let's start with Mark chapter 7, starting in the first verse. Now when the Pharisees gathered to him, with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, holding to the tradition of the elders. And then when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and scribes asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? Okay, now we've seen this pattern before. We're back in Mark 3, where the Pharisees come to Jesus with a why question. It's a why question on the surface, but it's a pretty thinly veiled accusation, right? This is not just, I want to know why. This is, hey, you guys are not keeping the rules, right? And in this case, the issue is another one of the traditions of the Pharisees. Now, this tradition, like most of their traditions, had its roots in the Mosaic Law. But the Pharisees had extended and interpreted and applied the law to the extent that sometimes they'd actually lost the original intent. Now, if you go back and read the law is full of discussion about cleanliness. It wasn't just a matter of washing your hands before you eat. There were a variety of things you could do in the law that would make you ceremonially unclean. For example, if you touched any kind of a dead animal or human body, if you had any kind of a skin disease like boils or rashes or sores, if you ate from an animal that was designated as unclean, or if you even came in contact with mildew on your clothes or in your house, all of those things would make you ceremonially unclean. And the point of that ceremonial uncleanness was that when you were that way, you couldn't go to the synagogue and worship with the people. And to our culture, that might have been, well, no big deal. I wouldn't have to go to church. But in a culture that was centered around the synagogue, this is the sort of hub of life. I mean, I tried to think of a sort of equivalent for us. It might be like for some of you being lifetime banned from Starbucks or maybe Metronome. But you see the notion that it really meant sort of withdrawing from the community. And the point of this ceremonial uncleanness was more than just a matter of sort of making good impressions. It was really a picture of the fact that we cannot come before a holy God without some kind of cleansing. You know, and from our perspective, when we read the Mosaic Law, it can seem kind of arbitrary and picky almost. And yet, if you begin to realize that the whole point of this was about painting a vivid picture that we cannot come before a holy God, not just because we can't make a good impression, but we simply cannot tolerate, we couldn't live through an encounter with a holy God because of our uncleanness. Now, I would argue that we kind of instinctively know this. Have you ever thought about if you have a meeting with somebody that's really you consider very important? Maybe you have an appointment with a political leader or somebody in the church whose opinion you really value, or you know a very important business client. Chances are, you're going to spend a little bit more time that day taking a shower, maybe smelling the armpits, you know, making sure that you're clean. I don't want to have any asparagus in my teeth, anything like that. And why do we do that? Because somehow we have this sort of innate need that I know I need to be clean there. Now, in that case, perhaps it's more to just make a good impression. But we have this sort of built-in notion that cleanliness is something we need. And we need to recognize that simply to be in the presence of a perfect and holy God requires cleanliness. And to their credit, the Pharisees understood this. They did understand that there was some cleanliness required. But the problem is that they had a distorted view of what cleanliness meant. And Jesus' reply to their question makes this perfectly clear. Look at verse 6, Mark 7, verse 6. And he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men.'" So Jesus is quoting here Isaiah 29, where the prophet Isaiah denounces the nation of Israel because they have taken these important rituals, these important traditions, and turned them into empty rituals and traditions. They had lost their love and devotion for God and continued the rituals, but they'd become kind of an empty shell, sort of a facade of what they were originally intended. It had become for them an external righteousness instead of an internal righteousness. And they had sort of concluded that if they kept the rules well enough, and perhaps pressured other people to keep the rules, their values and motivations didn't really matter. Now, that's easy for us to say, oh yeah, that was them. But one of the commentators I read while I was studying, a very insightful commentator, gave four sort of steps to a process that he says the Pharisees and probably all of us who have this kind of external righteousness view go through, taking a meaningful symbol and turning it into, in this case, actually an excuse for sin. And it kind of goes like this. Step one, and I think it's going to be up. Yeah, good. Step one, a spiritual truth is represented by a meaningful symbol. So in this case, the external hand washing, while certainly it had health benefits as well, it was really meant to be a visible symbol of our need to be clean before God, and that uncleanness separates us from God. Step two, the meaningful symbol becomes a required spiritual exercise. So when the symbol takes on such importance that people begin to attribute power to the symbol itself, then the ritual actually becomes the powerful part, not the symbol. And you see, this is what the Pharisees had done with hand washing. It became a required exercise, which they attributed power to in itself, instead of being a symbol of something internal. Now, here's where the process starts to take a very bad turn. Step three, the rite or ritual is substituted for the spiritual experience it represented. See, once you begin to ascribe worth to the rite or the ritual and not to what it represents, then in fact the rite or ritual can be completely separated from what it represents. Now, I would argue that that's really what's happened to a lot of people, at least in my generation, with going to church, right? Because going to church, coming together as a family and being reminded of who God is and what he's done for us is extremely valuable. I need that. In fact, Hebrews 10 tells us not to neglect it. And yet, as soon as we conclude that going to church somehow buys us God's favor or buys us some kind of value, we've actually taken that important thing and turned it into something very different. You know, I actually had an experience with this. A couple of weeks ago, I was hanging out with some neighbor friends of mine. And they were telling stories about a few years ago when we had a windstorm. A tree fell across the road just a block or two from us. And it fell across the road and actually very close to hit one of my neighbors. And one of my other neighbors, as we were just kind of talking about this and remembering, I happened to have walked down the road just moments after the tree fell, and this woman who's in her 70s was on the other side of the tree, and I could see she was back there, but I didn't know if it hit her. And she said, no, I'm okay. Well, my neighbor says something very interesting. He says, boy, it's a good thing you went to church the day before. It happened on a Sunday afternoon or a Monday, something like that. He said, it's a good thing you went to church. And I thought, wow, doesn't that speak to this sort of idea that somehow I'm going to buy some favor with God and good things will happen if I go to church? Now, step four, the ritual, and this is where the Pharisees really got into trouble. The ritual is perverted to justify sin. You see, once the ritual becomes what we put our trust in, it's relatively easy to actually separate it and use it as an excuse for sin. It's easy for us to compartmentalize life and turn Sunday into the day we make up for 6 days of choosing to live on our own power and say, hey, I got it, God. And then on Sunday, I'll sort of make up for that and keep up a facade that says, well, just in case God was angry at me, I'm going to come to church and maybe that'll appease him. And by the time we get to this point, we are where Jesus accused the Pharisees. We have hearts that are far from God. And in fact, I want to suggest to you that even though this commentator didn't, I would say there's even a step five that our culture has done, and that is they begin to recognize the meaninglessness of the ritual and toss that out too. And that's why we live in one of the most unchurched cultures in America. Because people look at the ritual and say, hey, it doesn't change anything. You go to church, but it doesn't really change you. So why bother? And you see, this is exactly what happened with the Pharisees. Now, Jesus goes on and he starts to give them an example. And I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time in his example because his example is probably a little culturally specific. It's a discussion of a tradition the Pharisees called Corban. And essentially, let me just kind of help you understand what it was, and we'll talk a little bit more about its implications. In this tradition, the Pharisees would encourage people to give some asset, money or something else, to the temple, but sort of at a future time. And in the meantime, you got to keep control of it. Now, we kind of have a sort of rough equivalent to that in what's called a charitable remainder trust, a situation where you can sort of give money to something that is going to go to the church or to another organization when you die, but in the meantime, you get to actually earn interest from it. It's actually a pretty cool tax benefit. Let me be clear, there's nothing wrong with that. There probably really wasn't anything wrong even with the whole practice that the Pharisees had done. But what they had done is they had taken that step forward and now said, you know what? You can do this and honor God even if it means you don't care for your family well. And I think the point of this, instead of really digging into the specific example that Jesus gave, the point of this is to understand the Pharisees' view of righteousness. You see, the Pharisees had what we've said called an external, and I want to go a little bit step farther and call it an outside-in view of righteousness. Their idea about righteousness was that it was primarily about behavior. It was primarily about what you do or don't do. And in fact, one of my favorite authors, there's a book called The Cure. I think I've recommended it to a number of you. In that book, they have this cool little righteousness equation. Okay, I think we're going to have that on the screen, right? Maybe not. The righteousness equation says godliness or righteousness equals less wrong behavior plus more right behavior. If you have an external or outside-in view of righteousness, righteousness is defined by less wrong behavior plus more right behavior. Now, the problem with this idea is that, frankly, for most of us, it doesn't take long before we discover that we are not good at changing our behavior. Now, some of you who are more disciplined than me, the kind who get up at 5 a.m. and go running even when it's snowing, okay, you guys might be better at changing your behavior. But the truth is, eventually, you're going to realize, and you probably already know deep in your heart, that you can't change your behavior well enough to be acceptable to a righteous and holy God. You can't do it. And if I can't do that, what do I do? If I can't change my behavior and be acceptable, what do I do? Well, you know what we often do? We put on masks. We end up pretending that we've got life more figured out than we really do, and we become hypocrites. You see, outside-in righteousness drives us to become hypocrites. It tends to force us to be into hypocrisy. Because if I can't change my behavior, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on a mask and I'm going to pretend that I have my act together better than I really do. I'm going to try to keep you at arm's length because, frankly, if I really realize that I'm putting on a mask and trying to be better than I really am, I don't want you too close to me. Because if you discover what I'm really like, you're going to probably not accept me. And so this sort of outside-in view of righteousness not only pushes us to be hypocrites, but then to wear a mask and pretend that we have life together and keep people at arm's length lest they get into enough relationship with me to discover that it really is a mask I'm wearing. And do you see what that does? Worse yet, we actually even begin to believe that we can do that with God. That I can keep him at arm's length and pretend to have my life together and go to church and do all those things when deep in my heart I really know that's not who I am. And I hold people at arm's length. I can't receive their love or God's love because they have to love a mask, not me. So you see, outside-in righteousness leads to hypocrisy. Secondly, outside-in righteousness leads to dualism. It not only forces us to wear masks, but it inevitably forces us to separate life into two camps, religious life and secular or the rest of life. There's a part of life where we go to church, where we put on the mask, we smile and be uber nice people at church, and then we go on, get on Monday and we go to the rest of life, real life, some of us might even have the guts to say. And unfortunately for most of us, that line between spiritual life and real life is drawn right through Sunday. On Sunday, I'm going to greet everybody warmly. I'm going to smile big. I'm going to say, I'm great. I'm fine. I'm wonderful. I'm going to be really try to be nice to people. Maybe I'm even going to volunteer to help in the church or in the kids, though that's really pushing it. But the truth is, on Monday, when I get back to normal, it is, after all, a dog-eat-dog world out there, especially in business. And so one answer might be, well, you know what? Let's just add some more religious stuff. Let's go to missional community on Wednesday night and go to church on Sunday and maybe get uber spiritual and go to some training or something like that. And if I can move the line and I'm spending more time on spiritual stuff and less in the regular world, then I'll be good. But you see ultimately that it's causing us to divide life into two pieces. And in that, I can never abide in Jesus on a daily basis because I've divided life into a spiritual half and a secular half. Jesus wants us to worship him in all of life, not just an hour on Sunday morning, 2 hours on Wednesday night, maybe a training now and then. And it is a losing battle to divide life into secular and spiritual. We'll never be able to abide in Jesus that way. Third, outside-in righteousness leads to separatism. This is one of the things the Pharisees just displayed in grandeur. If I believe that righteousness is fundamentally about what I do and fundamentally comes from the outside, then I also am going to tend to believe that unrighteousness comes from things I come in contact with. And this idea quickly leads us to separate ourselves from people that are less holy than us. You know, we see a really powerful example of this in Luke chapter 18, where Jesus tells that story of the Pharisees and the tax collector praying in the temple. Remember that? Remember what the Pharisee said in his prayer? He said, God, I thank you that I am not like the other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all I get. Do you hear the Pharisee's righteousness equation? It is less wrong behavior, robbery, adultery, evildoers, whatever, plus more right behavior, fasting and tithing. That equals righteousness. And you know what? If that equation were right, the Pharisees ought to be the most righteous guys on the planet. And yet, you don't have to read the Gospels very long to see that that's who Jesus was often the hardest on. Clearly, their understanding of righteousness had a desperate flaw. And ultimately, this idea of an external righteousness that causes me to be impacted by the messy people in the world causes me to actually separate myself from the people God's called me to. And so the church lives out its mission, if you will. It fights evil with protest rallies and political actions, and we stay inside our walls, safe from the dirtiness of the world, while we send our kids to Christian school and only listen to Christian radio stations and avoid relationships with people because down deep I'm concerned that their dirtiness might rub off on me. But you see, Jesus' understanding of righteousness was completely different. Well, the Pharisees had an outside-in view of righteousness. Jesus' view of righteousness was inside out. And he explains that starting in verse 14 of Mark 7. As he said, and he called the people to him again and said to them, hear me, all of you, and understand, there is nothing outside a person that going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he'd entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within, and they defile a person. So do you see how Jesus turned the whole thing back around to their original complaint? And he points out that it is the center of the heart, the center of our values and our motivations that really define righteousness or unrighteousness. Now, there's good news and bad news in this. The bad news is, if I can't change my behavior, what's the chances I'm going to be able to change my heart? I mean, if I have been unsuccessful at getting my bad habits changed, how in the world am I going to change my heart? Well, what if we don't have to? What if we could get a heart transplant and suddenly want to do the right things? What if we could be, from the inside out, be given a heart that says, I want to do less of the wrong things and more of the right things. Not because somehow I need to put on a mask and show people that I do, but because that's what my heart wants. And you see, that is exactly what Jesus is offering us in the gospel. God recognized that we couldn't change our hearts, our behavior, much less our hearts and motivation. So he sent Jesus, and Jesus lives the perfect life in every respect, in every day, in every moment of life, on my behalf. And then, if that weren't enough, he willingly takes on the punishment for my sin. And all the ways I haven't followed God, all the times I've been a hypocrite and worn a mask and looked like I had my life together more than I had. You see, God treated Jesus. I don't know if you ever thought about this. Just every time I think about it, it blows me away. Think of the worst, most evil, horrible person you have ever thought about. I don't know about for you. I'm older than you guys, but if you ever watched the movie Schindler's List, there's a scene in that movie where there's a man, presumably a German, standing on his balcony, target practicing on people in this prison camp. Just picking up his rifle in the morning, he's out with his cup of coffee, aiming and shooting people for fun. Now, I don't know about you, but I watch that and I get angry and it stirs my heart. This man deserves hell. What blows me away is that God treated Jesus as if he had done that. In fact, not just that guy, but all of my sin and all of yours and all of every sinner in the world. So God takes all of that stuff and piles it on Jesus, and he willingly takes it for me. And then he treats me as if I lived the perfect life that Jesus did. That, if that doesn't blow you away, you don't get it, okay? The Spirit of God has not yet made that clear. And yeah, it's amazing news, Randy. It's incredible news. And even more amazing is that when we accept that gift, Jesus plants in us a brand new heart that wants to follow him. That's what 1 Corinthians 5 tells us. He says, behold, all things have become new. The Spirit of God has actually planted in me a completely remodeled, or completely new, not remodeled, completely new. I got a transplant, and the Spirit of God now lives in me, and that heart wants to please and obey God. That's inside-out righteousness. You know, if you've never trusted Jesus and accepted that gift of a transplanted heart, all I really want to say to you is give up. Because trust me, your efforts at trying to change your behavior, let alone change your heart, aren't going to work. You don't need to patch up and remodel and try to clean up your heart. You need a new one. And there's only one place you can get that. The God who created your heart in the first place is willing to give us a completely righteous, holy heart. Yeah, my old nature is still around, and I still have a choice as to whether to live out of that beautiful, amazing, holy new heart God's given me or go back to my old way. I still have that choice, but for the first time ever, I actually have a heart that wants to follow Jesus. That's good news. Now, I know for probably most of us in here, at some point, you've actually have trusted Jesus. And you actually do have the Holy Spirit of God living in you. But you've succumbed to the lie that you're responsible for trying to clean up and fix up your heart. And that's really, really frustrating. And in fact, I believe what it ends up doing for most of us is it causes us to wear masks. I don't get to be real because church, you know, it's really kind of sad, frankly, that church, the one place here as family where it ought to be safe for us to be real, because I am a sinner saved by grace. I'm still a mess. And it ought to be really, really safe to do that. And it's sad that very often the church is the place that we most put the mask on, that we most pretend to be something we're not, because somehow I need your approval. What if we were to recognize that we have God's perfect, complete, unconditional delight? He loves me. And, you know, for me, what was really stunning for me is he doesn't just love me, he actually likes me. I mean, maybe that seems a little redundant, but, you know, to me, wow, God, you don't love me just because you kind of have to. You made the rules and I obeyed them, and so now you have to. You delight in me because he looks at me and he sees his perfect son. That changes everything. And now I have actually the freedom to be real. Because I don't have to pretend to be something I'm not. So when we come to communion tonight, I want to encourage you, with what of your missional communities here, to first thank Jesus. Because here is a ritual. Okay, now hopefully we have not gone down those steps and decided that this and turned this ritual into some sort of empty, meaningless thing that somehow is going to earn God's favor. You cannot earn God's favor by drinking grape juice and or wine dipped in bread. Okay, you can't do it. You don't need to. But what this will do, if it's that meaningful symbol of step one, is it'll remind you of the enormous cost that God paid to reconcile us to himself. That's why we do it. At least I hope that's why we do it. But if that doesn't make any sense to you, I want to encourage you to come and pray with one of our leaders, with myself or somebody else, because what you most need, what all of us most need, is relationship with the God who did this for us. The God who offers a clean, holy, righteous heart that can change us from the inside out and make us want to obey him. Let's pray.